This hour, we're talking about traveling by book, about the places that books can take us in space and in time. Here's Ruth Ozeki reading from her best-selling novel, A Tale for the Time Being.
Hi, my name is Nao, and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is? Well, if you give me a moment, I will tell you. A time being is someone who lives in time, and that means you and me and every one of us who is or was or ever will be. As for me, right now, I'm sitting in a French maid cafe in Akiba Electricity Town, listening to a sad chanson that's playing sometime in your past, which is also my present, writing this and wondering about you somewhere in my future. And if you're reading this, then maybe by now you're wondering about me too. You wonder about me. I wonder about you.
Ruth, this character now has such a vibrant, distinctive voice when she really kind of jumps off the page from the very beginning. How did she come to be?
You know, at the time, I guess it was probably 2004, 2005, I was studying the fascicles, the essays of a 13th century Zen master named Dogen Zenji. And he'd written an essay called Uji, which can be translated as time being or being time or for the time being. But for some reason, every time I was reading this essay, I kept reading time being as in like time being, like human being, right? And this phrase just kind of stayed in my mind and somehow just translated itself into the voice of this 16-year-old Japanese schoolgirl, Nao Yasutani.
So tell us about Nao. How would you describe her to someone who hasn't met her?
Well, I guess I would describe her as displaced. She is a Japanese girl born in Japan, but was raised in Silicon Valley in Sunnyvale, California. And the family was forced to move back to Tokyo, where she was put into a junior high school and, you know, had none of the cultural fluency. You know, she didn't have money for nice stuff, and she just didn't really know how to relate to the other kids. And so she is being very badly bullied. She decides that she's going to kill herself. But before she does, she wants to do one last act of redemption, which is to tell the fascinating life story of her 104-year-old great-grandmother, who is a Zen Buddhist nun.
Oh. Now, you are also yourself a Zen Buddhist priest. I think you were ordained in 2010.
That's right.
Are there elements of Zen Buddhist philosophy that you wanted to explore or embed in this novel, particular elements?
Well, I think that more than that, it's kind of the other way around. In the years prior to writing this novel, I was practicing Zen Buddhism very seriously, and I was doing a lot of meditating and a lot of study of Zen philosophy. And I think the book really grew out of that. It wasn't so much that I wanted to embed Zen philosophy in the book, but it was more
the
that
novel the embedded itself in your practice.
Exactly, exactly. And in a way, the novel is an expression of that practice.
In what way?
You know, I guess the way I like to think about it is, in a sense, the book is a performance of certain Zen philosophies. For example, Zen teachings on time and impermanence, or Zen teachings on interconnectedness, what is called in Buddhism dependent co-arising, the way that we are never separate from each other. You know, there's no separation between self and other. And I think that all of these kinds of philosophical propositions, if you read the book with those in mind, you can see how the book kind of enacts those.
But you're suggesting, aren't you, also that our notion of self or of having an independent self in the real world is something of a myth, an illusion.
It is an illusion. Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. I mean, there's no way to be an independent self, is there? How could you possibly be an independent self? We come from somewhere. We come from our mothers and our fathers. You know, we can't survive. We can't survive for a minute without others around us. You know, we're like waves in the ocean. We rise up from the ocean and appear very briefly as a little white speck, piece of foam in the water, but then we subside again into the larger ocean. And we're time beings in that sense. We rise out of time and then we fall back into time.
Or I was going to say, another way of putting it is we're all ghosts.
Yes, or we're all ghosts, exactly.
Yeah, there, exactly. And there are some real ghosts in this book also. Now meets the ghost of
Haruki. Yes, that's right. Her great uncle, Haruki number one. That's right.
So I'm curious. Western culture, of course, has this long history of ghost lore and ghost stories, but the notion of ghosts in Japanese culture, and especially in Zen Buddhist culture, I think is somewhat different.
That's right. My grandmother, for example, always kept a small shrine, a small altar, in her house, no matter where she went. And every day she would wake up in the morning and she would boil hot water for tea, and she would bring a cup of hot water to the altar and give it to my grandfather, who had been dead for many years, but this was her ritual, and in a sense, it kept him there. It kept him alive and present in her life. In Japanese culture, the ancestors are never, never far away. They live just on the other side, and they visit frequently. I mean, certainly once a year, there's a wonderful festival called Obon, which appears in the book as well, but it's a bit like the Mexican Day of the Dead, where the ancestors come back to visit the living.
I read an interview with you recently in which you referred to a Japanese word or concept, kotodama, which means something like the spirit in words. I don't know much about the concept, but it made me wonder, can words sort of have ghosts?
Well, I think they are ghosts. Words are ghosts. Language is a ghostly kind of ritual that we perform. We've inherited language from the dead, right? Mm-hmm. And so every time we speak words, we are actually speaking the language of the dead, the tongues of the dead. Language is ghostly.
That makes me wonder whether writing is a form of Zen practice for you, or vice versa, or I guess how the two inform each other.
The two are very, very close, to the point where I would almost say at this point they are expressions of each other. How's that? You know, I've been meditating for many years, and I find that the relationship between the two practices really is very intimate and mutually supportive. You know, they're both contemplative practices. They both require a kind of a tuning in to the mind in a particular kind of way. They're wonderfully supportive of each other.
And circling back to that theme of time, they both seem to me to be practices that are part of an effort to change our relationship to time or change our perception of time.
That's a wonderful thought, because I think one of the things that meditation teaches you, you could actually say that meditation is a way of practicing patience. It's a way of learning to wait for nothing. And and this is very, very useful for a novel writer. As Now points out in the book, it's very difficult to keep up with the mind. You know, as a writer, it's very difficult to kind of keep up with the mind. And you always feel like you're just lagging behind slightly. But I think that once something has been written, then we can look at that and we can think, yes, that is an expression of a moment in time. And so in a way, a book is a time capsule. Hmm. And, you know, it reminds me too of the ancient Greeks used to believe when you recited the poems of a dead poet, it was actually the dead poet who was borrowing your tongue in order to make himself or herself understood.
Huh. Well, this would be a great way to ask for one more reading as we close. There's a scene when Now meets the ghost of her long-dead uncle who was a kamikaze pilot. Would you read that scene for us?
Okay. So in this scene, Now is visiting her great-grandmother at a tiny little temple on the hillside. And she was sitting on the temple steps when she was visited by her great-uncle's ghost. And her great-uncle is named Haruki Number One. "Stupid Now, what a foolish girl. There I was sitting with the ghost of my dead great-uncle, who just happened to be a kamikaze fighter pilot in World War II, and who was probably the most fascinating person I will ever get to meet. And what did I do? Sing some stupid French chanson to him? How idiotic is that? He must have thought I was just another typical dumb teenager, and his time on Earth was precious, so why waste even a moment of it with me? Better to just shimmer off and hang out with someone who could think of more interesting conversational topics. What is wrong with me? I could have asked him about all sorts of things. I could have asked him about his interests and his hobbies. I could have asked him if only depressed people cared about philosophy and if reading philosophy books ever helped. I could have asked him about what it felt like to be ripped from his happy life and forced to become a suicide bomber, and if the other guys in his unit picked on him because he wrote French poetry. I could have asked him how he felt when he woke up on the morning of his mission, which was also his last morning on Earth. Did he have a big cold fish dying in the hollow of his stomach? Or was he filled with a luminous calm that emanated from him so that everyone around him stood back in awe, knowing that he was ready to take to the sky? I could have asked him what it felt like to die. stupid. Baka nao yastani.
Ruth, thank you so much.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And one other quick question. Let me just see. Do we have another couple of minutes in the studio, Kirill? So, Ruth, the other thing, I hate to spring this on you, but and if you don't want to do it, it's fine. But when we get writers in the studio, we're asking them what they've read that they would like to recommend to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And ideally, a book that you think most people haven't or a lot of people haven't really heard of or noticed. Could be something very old and obscure. Could be something you read as a child and adored, could be something brand new that you just read that's not getting a lot of play. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that comes to mind?
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Can you set it up by just saying, I'm Ruth Ozeki, and a book I think everybody should read, or a book I'd like to recommend, something like that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. My name is Ruth Ozeki, and I am the author of the novel A Tale for the Time Being. The book I would like to recommend is Kamikaze Diaries, Reflections of Japanese Student Soldiers by professor of anthropology named Emiko Onuki Tierney. Professor Onuki Tierney takes the diaries, the letters, essays, and poetry written by the Japanese students who were conscripted and forced to join the Tokotai, the kamikaze forces. What I found remarkable about these books is the way that they humanized these pilots. In America, of course, when you talk about kamikaze, the stereotyping of that word has become the predominant image that we have of these young men. But in fact, a lot of the pilots who were conscripted were really the creme de la creme of young Japanese intellectuals. They were fluent in many European languages. They read French poetry. They read German philosophy. They were able to think about and to discuss and to write about the moral and ethical problems of war and the challenges that they faced in a way that I found absolutely heartbreaking. The young men who are writing these letters and the diaries are so present on the page. They really emerge as sensitive, young, intelligent men who are, you know, confronting death. And not only confronting death, but confronting the worst possible kind of death, knowing that their death will be contributing to the war. Many of them were opposed to the war. They were in a real moral bind. This is a book that I read in 2006 or 2007, you know, the period of time following 9/11, when the word kamikaze was being, you know, and suicide bomber was being used in quite a different context, used, I think, in a very, I would say, almost irresponsible way. And so this is a book that I think is really reclaiming, you know, a piece of history that has really been erased by World War II propaganda. It's a book that I think is incredibly important.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay. That's absolutely
perfect.
Sorry
about that.
No,
that
it's great. It's great. We'll edit it, clean it up. You'll
All right.
You'll love it. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you for great questions, too.
Okay.
I appreciate that. Okay.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.